business of the day, indemnity insurance versus Hanjin Shipping. Snyder.
Good morning. Judge Flom.
Good morning.
This case arises in the most unusual circumstances. The appellant Hanjin did exactly what was requested of it by the owner of the goods, which I'll refer to. Pardon me?
I have to ask you, in a sense, how unusual this really is in the following way. One of the things that was unclear to me after reading all of the briefs in this case was what industry custom is when a shipment, an overseas shipment, is diverted for a period of time for customs inspection, something which isn't unusual at all. It happens in a certain number of cases, maybe 1% of cases, maybe a little less, because that's what this is really about. It's during that diversion that the container is lost. And I certainly understand your position that Hanjin, the carrier, at that stage, according to instructions it received, relinquished control of the shipment to third parties. We have this whole set of third parties, so we won't even get into who at the moment. But your argument seemed to me to go too far to say, well, at that point, your hands were washed of the shipment forever and ever. You know, if it had been diverted in Long Beach, California, maybe you would have just collected your fee to Indiana and never had to look at it again. Surely we're talking about what happens, who bears the risk of loss during a customs diversion? And I had trouble finding anything in the record to help me on that point.
Well, an intensive custom examination such as this was does neither facilitate nor expedite the transportation of the goods to their ultimate destination. In fact, it interferes with the transportation of the goods, it interrupts the transportation, and it delays the transportation.
But is it so unpredictable that there's no even industry custom? I didn't see anything in the way bill, for example, that tried to address what Hanjin's responsibilities would be and what the consignee's responsibilities would be should there be such a diversion. Is that correct? The way bill doesn't talk about this possibility.
Oh, I think it does. That was a large part of our case. It says on the face of the way bill that Hanjin will endeavor to deliver the goods to the destination stated above. And then it gives the owner of the goods the right to change its mind as to where it wants the goods to go, and it says that Hanjin will deliver the goods elsewhere upon a written instruction from the consignee, but Hanjin will not be responsible for what happens after that delivery. And that's a very big part of our case, and it's right on the face of the bill of lading.
Right, but suppose Fritz had, after the inspection was over, suppose Fritz had promptly issued instructions to O'Hare or Channel or whoever it is we're going to talk about to get the goods back into Hanjin's hands for the final phase of the trip. You would have had to take them back.
Absolutely.
Under the contract.
No question about it.
Okay. So you weren't, like, really finished with him. You were just temporarily finished with him because of this written instruction.
We may have been. It's not clear in the record whether there's no evidence in the record that Lowe's still wanted the goods in Indiana. I mean, logistic plans for goods change all the time, particularly with these huge companies, retail distributors,
a country, what, nationwide. Lowe's, you know, is this huge hardware store with, you know, one warehouse may be full. They may not be, this, you know, all of these importers play this just-in-time logistics plan. They don't want the goods any longer in their warehouse than they absolutely have to be there. They try throughout this transportation, modern transportation, is predicated on the premise that goods will keep moving and no lost time, because lost time is always lost money, one way or the other. And this diversion was not an incident of the transportation of the goods. Lowe's is importing dutiable merchandise, power tools manufactured abroad. And it has the duty under the customs regulations to present these goods for examination.
Right.
Hanjin has no such duty to present them for examination. This is between Lowe's and customs.
Right, the importer and customs.
Hanjin never contracted
right.
to bear the risk for the loss of these goods while they were not in Hanjin's transportation scheme.
Could I ask you a question that might seem a little bit off base, but it gets into this risk of loss thing? I inferred from the terms of the waybill that's in the record that Hanjin is a company that ships all over the world. It seems to have been talking about the Hague rules, or the Hague Visby
yes.
rules, or the Hamburg rules, or whatever, because obviously different countries have different sets of rules. So Hanjin, as a carrier, uses a contract that will sort of fit all situations. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And
there's really no significant difference between the Hague rules, Hague-Visby rules, Hamburg rules, and the Carriage of Goods by Sea Act in the context of this case.
In this case, yeah.
All of those, they all stem from the Hague Convention of 1926, and they all contain the exception of act or fault of the shipper.
The act of shipper. Is your standard bill of lading to which you refer in your brief in the record?
No.
Okay. So that's not something we can take into account then?
Well, it's not in the record because the plaintiff didn't object to the application of COGS until the morning of trial. And it was only a day and a half trial, and we didn't consider it necessary to have that bill of lading to put in evidence, because we both had agreed that COGSA would apply. The plaintiff pleaded that in his complaint, and we agreed to that in our answer.
Can you explain to me why it makes a difference to you if COGSA applies versus Illinois law, for example? I thought you argued in your brief also that everybody had an active shipper
right.
defense.
That's
so
true.
In the end, it really just was a detail. Is there anything that this turns on?
Well, there is, but it's larger than this case. The district court is now at odds with several other courts in the Northern District of Illinois that have had the occasion to address losses occurring to goods shipped under a through bill of lading after they've arrived in Chicago. They have routinely applied COGSA. Now, in this instance, it really makes no difference, because under any law that could conceivably apply, Hanjin must be exonerated. But there may be other states that have different laws. And if this court applies state law in this case, then if other courts will apply state law in all the other cases. And this industry sorely needs a uniform scheme of rules and rights, liabilities, immunities for this intermodal transportation. And see, the problem with Carmack is that LEP transport was decided by this circuit court. And the district court is bound by LEP transport. I'm bound by LEP LEP transport. And if I understand things correctly, you're bound by LEP transport until it's overruled en banc.
Right.
But LEP was decided in 1992 when there was a requirement for the inland carrier to file a rate schedule. And this is all referred to, by the way, in the court's decision in Temple Steel, which is... But in 1995, the Congress passed the Interstate Commerce Termination Act.
Right. Yeah.
And it recodified CARMAC.
Mm-hmm.
And the definition of a water carrier includes a water carrier that brings goods from a place outside the United States to a place inside the United States and then transships them to another place within the United States. And Section 1406 has a specific, Title 49, Section 14706. That's in our appendix, by the way. It has a provision specifically applying to water carriers engaged in transporting goods using subcontractors such as railroads and truckers on through bills of lading. And it provides that the water carrier's bill of lading will apply.
You know,
it doesn't require the truckers to issue any bill of lading or the railroad to the shipper.
I have two reactions to what you're saying, one of which is that one of the problems I had with your COGS argument, and I appreciate what you're saying about when this came up, is that the bills of lading or the way bills in some cases are much more clear in their intention to extend COGS to the full range of the transportation that's being involved. And the other thought I'm having is that, I mean, of course, it's always possible for counsel to ask this court to reconsider an earlier case, but this doesn't seem to me very well developed here.
No, so no, it is not very well developed here. No one urged that in the district court, and I'm not urging it here because the goods were not in transportation. They were not moving when they were stolen. They were resting at the customs examination station, which was one of four in the city, and which was chosen by Lowe's.
Let me ask you something.
Yes.
CARMAC amendment stuff is interesting, but whatever happened? Where did the... It was a whole truck full of Black & Decker power tools. How did somebody steal that? Were they ever recovered? What happened?
I am sorry to say this is not an uncommon occurrence. Cartage theft in Chicago is as old as Chicago itself, I think.
The Sopranos are in New Jersey.
Well, that's true, Judge, but I was having a conversation with an elderly police officer who told me, I'm now arresting the third generation of cargo, of cartage theft, of thieves. And the container was found empty in northern Indiana on its chassis with no tractor attached to it. Someone came in this unguarded, ungated facility, backed its tractor up to the container, and pulled it away.
But then they have to unload all this stuff? I mean, this is...
Was
there an FBI investigation, and did anybody ever get nailed for it, or what happened? I admit this doesn't have anything to do with the
right.
exciting question
That's
of
right.
the bills waiting and the CARMAC amendment. So
we have had cases where doors have been taken off containers and replaced with the seal intact.
Is that because the seal doesn't wrap around the truck?
The seal...
I know where the seal goes. Does right. they have seals?
It doesn't wrap around the truck, no.
You would think that we would move toward that...
well, we're moving toward a lot of tampering devices, including devices that broadcast to a satellite when somebody touches them.
Wow.
Right.
But let me ask you a more prosaic question. Lois Walker testified that the reason this container wasn't picked up after the customs inspection was completed was because Hanjin didn't supply a pickup number And I just wanted to get your response to that, because that's the only evidence I see in this record that Hanjin had any culpability for the fact that it was sitting there instead of moving along.
Right. Well, I must say that Ms. Walker was badly informed. Ms. Walker didn't have the goods. And it's the Bailey of the goods that determines what is necessary to pick them up. Channel Distribution and O'Hare Services had the goods, and they do not use a pickup number system. What they were looking for is the same thing that Fritz, what they were looking for is the same...
I'm sorry, I don't know what that was.
What was that?
No, you did nothing.
You did nothing, yes, go ahead.
What they were
it's a statement by GSA about the case.
Somebody working with a Black & Decker power tool.
Sorry to distract you, yes.
What was testified to by Yoshio Goto of O'Hare Services and by Alan Muir of Channel Distribution, their testimony was congruent. And it was, what we need to deliver these goods is we need a delivery order from Fritz.
And that's because Fritz is the one who
that's
turned
right,
over to
bailor.
Begin with. To
I mean,
bailor, right. Right. Do you have a position, just quickly before you may be wanting to say something for rebuttal, as between Channel and O'Hare, who argue in their brief to us, the other guy did it, somebody must have been the bailee. Do you have a position as to who it was, or is your position that somehow they were jointly, or what's your position on
that? Well, our position is that it was Channel Distribution, because O'Hare Services had the license from Customs to operate this facility, but it didn't have the physical equipment and facilities to operate the facility. And it subcontracted the physical handling of the container to Channel Distribution. Now, Channel Distribution would have, as I understand their argument, it's that when we when Customs released it, we sent it back to, we left it back to Goto, in Goto's portion of the parking lot.
Right.
Okay. Thank you, Snyder. Mr. Arcelli?
It pleases the court, my name is Robert Osojic, and I represent Indemnity Insurance Company of North America. Your Honor, there are two issues in this case. One, the appeal brought by Hanjin, and our cross appeal as to the district court's ruling with respect to our bailment and negligence claims against Channel Distribution and O'Hare Services. With respect to Hanjin's appeal, we believe that the district court was correct in finding that Hanjin was liable for the full amount of damages in this case.
Can I ask you about that? Because in thinking of who is able to control a shipment, who should bear the risk of loss, it seems to me pretty clear that once Fritz had taken, you know, custody, in a sense, had instructed Hanjin to take the goods on these, or allow the goods to be taken on this detour for customs, Hanjin had no right to do anything to the goods. They couldn't have pulled up a truck to the yard and taken them away from Channel. They couldn't have protected them. They couldn't have posted a guard there. They were absolutely out of Hanjin's control. So why does it make sense to hold Hanjin as an insurer of goods when, in fact, because the deal's worldwide, these things could have been in Itasca, Illinois, or they could have been in Vancouver, Canada, or they could have been in El Salvador. How does Hanjin protect against that kind of risk of loss? And what's industry custom here?
They protect against that risk of loss by either agreeing to ship only to the port in California, which they could have done, or by putting some sort of provision, perhaps, in their contract. But the law states...
But what provision? See, the thing that I'm worried about is, in fact, we do have a lot of intermodal transport today, and it's efficient to have one company responsible, but I'm not even sure how they'd figure out what kind of insurance to buy if they're insuring against such a huge set of unknown risks. your theory seems to think that even though they have no control whatsoever over the goods during this detour loop that the goods go on, which is a very predictable event in international commerce, why doesn't their responsibility pick up again when the Fritz, the consignee, turns the goods back over to them after the detour?
Your Honor, first off, Fritz never had any actual control. Fritz is actually in Savannah, Georgia, throughout this process.
No, but Fritz was the one who instructed them, let the goods go to customs, right? Fritz gives them the written instructions. Do you think they should have thrown them in the wastebasket?
No, but as well, Your Honor, Fritz has no choice but obviously to comply with the customs order.
That doesn't matter. As long as Fritz is the one with the authority, if I had written Hanjin a letter and said, give the goods to somebody else, they would have been entirely entitled to disregard my gratuitous letter, right? So you must have some theory why they were not entitled to disregard Fritz's letter.
Right. They weren't entitled to disregard it, but if we look at their contract, their waybill, they state that they will transport these goods from China to North Vernon, Indiana. Doesn't say anywhere else. Hanjin is an experienced carrier. Their only witness at trial testified that Customs performs intensive examination of the goods that they're carrying 5 to 12 times a week. So they know when the parties enter into this agreement, they know that it may be inspected by customs. So
that's
knowing
about,
that...
That's from a half to 1% of their shipments.
Correct.
Actually, out of 1,200 shipments, 5 times a week is somewhere in the order of a half a percent.
But, again, Your Honor, it's not in the realm of the impossible or the unknown or a divergence. Goods coming, and particularly from China to the United States, are at times inspected by customs. So that's something that they knew before they entered into the contract. They agreed to transport it to North Vernon, Indiana, and they got paid for transporting
right.
it to North Vernon.
And they agreed that if Fritz had given them the goods back, they would have finished transporting them to North Vernon, Indiana. But my problem is, doesn't the waybill assume that the goods are in fact under their control at all times, that their control or that of the agents that they're choosing to use, whatever, the rail company, the trucking company, under their control? And were the goods not under somebody else's control while they were at customs?
Your Honor, we respectfully disagree that the waybill indicates that Hanjin is only liable if the goods are in their control or their agent's control. It doesn't speak to that. It basically says the place of delivery is North Vernon, Indiana. They agreed to transport it there. They were paid for it.
But your theory is they should have ignored the customs order, gotten them to North Vernon, Indiana, and then said to you, it's your problem to ship them back to Itasca.
Your Honor, I certainly don't suggest that they disregard a customs order to inspect the goods. However, based on the party's contract, the risk of loss was definitely on Hanjin until the goods were delivered to the place of delivery, which is North Vernon, Indiana. Hanjin conceded that even when the railway carrier had the goods, if they were damaged, Hanjin would be liable on the contract.
That's entirely different. That's not a taking the goods out of their control or that of one of their agents. The railroad carrier was their agent. Of course they're responsible, if that's the way Bill says. But my concern is its allocation of risk of loss while this unique circumstance, the government, you know, deciding whether these goods will be actually admitted into the country and cleared, takes them away from Hanjin. If the government had taken that container and it was filled with counterfeit Black & Decker tools, counterfeiting is a huge problem with China, then Hanjin would never have gotten the goods back because the government would have seized them under its authority to do so. So Hanjin doesn't know what's going to happen to the goods at the time Customs takes them.
Your Honor, under that scenario, Hanjin would have a defense under Carmack, Federal Law, or CAGSA by saying, hey, this is now a government authority action which caused us not to deliver to North Vernon, Indiana. That's not the case here. If their defense is, yes, we're liable, except for this defense, which is stated in federal common law or Carmack or CAGSA, and apparently their defense is act of shipper. They don't say that loads itself caused the loss. What they're saying is, well, Fritz told us to go ahead and give to customs pursuant to a customs order, therefore we wash our hands. But that's not the cause of the loss. complying with the customs order isn't what caused the damage or the non-delivery. It was sent to customs. It was examined by customs. There's records of that, and it's in the record. And at some point, though, it disappeared from the Channel Distribution O'Hare lot. But again, the act of shipper defense, there was no evidence, as the district court indicated, to prove that defense. It's their burden to show that defense, to show an exception to liability, as indicated by CAGSA, CARMAC, or federal common law.
How could they have gotten the container back without Fritz's cooperation?
Your Honor, Kim Walker of Fritz testified that she gets notice from customs via computer link-up. The computer link-up, she indicated, Hanjin has, so therefore Hanjin can see exactly when the customs examination is over. She testified that Hanjin was supposed to provide an additional pickup number, and they did it, and that was the delay.
Why does it help to have two different pickup numbers? Was there one number when they released it and a wholly different number?
It is my understanding there is there at one point to pick it up from the railway station to send it to customs, and that there would be another number to actually pick it up from the O'Hare Channel Distribution lot.
And you agree that this testimony of Lois Walker was inconsistent with the other testimony that said, no, in fact, the way it's done is the person who gave it to Channel is the person who has to authorize Channel's release of it. See, Channel could be liable if they gave it to the wrong person. You would agree with that. They can't just give it to somebody who pulls up with a truck.
Correct.
So the Channel has to know that, or O'Hare, whoever, one or the other, that they're giving it back to the right entity.
Correct.
What evidence is good enough for Channel or O'Hare to give it up? What did they look for typically?
I believe they testified that they needed also a number. And although Yoshio Goto...
Not from Hanjin, though.
Pardon?
They didn't say they needed a number from Hanjin.
Well, they would need a number from the carrier, the local carrier, who's going to pick it up from their lot. I think that's the person who would give them the number to go ahead and say, here's the number, we're going to pick up this 40-foot container from their lot.
What does the evidence say? What does the evidence say about what Channel or O'Hare, whoever it is we should be focusing on, needs before they can release that container? They don't just put it out on the street.
Correct.
They need something to justify turning it over to another individual. What do they need? What does the evidence say?
I think Alan Muir testified that he needed a pickup number from Fritz or from the carrier who's going to come.
Well, I think he said from Fritz, didn't he?
He may have said from Fritz,
carrier.
Yes. But I don't think there was direct communication between Fritz and them. I think what he was thinking is it has to come from the customs broker who's going to give it to the actual carrier who's going to come to the lot and pick up the container.
I thought the evidence showed that customs actually notified Fritz that the container had cleared and was ready for pickup.
That is correct. Tim Walker testified that through the computer link-up, she was notified that the customs examination had completed and that the container was ready for pickup. But she also testified that that same information is provided to Hanjin as well.
So how can she speak for Hanjin? Did customs notify Hanjin directly? I thought the evidence didn't show that.
Your Honor, it did. She testified that both Hanjin and Fritz had this computer link-up or via the computer system that they use, and they both had noticed that the customs inspection had proceeded and that the container was ready for pickup.
But is notice enough to entitle Channel or O'Hare to release the container to Hanjin? Hanjin shows up and says, well, we found out it's ready. Is that enough?
Apparently not. Channel Distribution and O'Hare at least specified that they do need a pickup number. But, Your Honor, if we look at the case, for instance, of Temple Steel, which is a Seventh Circuit case, the facts are very similar to this case. You had a case where a shipment, although being transported from the United States to a foreign country, stopped at a customs inspection site and at some point disappeared. And in that case, this court ruled that the carrier was still liable, and it pointed to the carrier's contract that said, look, carrier, you were to transport this to the ultimate destination. If you did not want to remain liable while it was inspected by Customs, you should have indicated so.
Which case are you referring to?
That's the Temple Steel case, Your Honor.
Temple never, that was decided under the Carmack Amendment, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
And it never mentioned the active shipper defense, does it?
I don't believe it does, Your Honor, but I think the opinion does go to the fact of this case. And
I understand the facts, but the Carmack Amendment really locks that case in to its finding. We don't have that. We don't
correct.
Have that quite such a situation here. We don't have that situation.
Well, Your Honor, there is case law out there, because what we have with this case is Congress goes tackle, typically is governed tackle to tackle. So unless it's extended by contract, which it wasn't in this case, CAGSA wouldn't apply. Carmack, on the other hand, indicates that if you have a transportation of cargo from a foreign country, it may not apply. So in this situation, as the district court indicated in its opinion, the legislation out there in the Act aren't covering essentially what's going on today in the country with respect to this intermodal transportation, where you have a container on a ship that's then taken on a railway and then put on a chassis. In those situations, and we believe that the federal common law comes to play to fit into the gap that's presented in this case, where CAGSA doesn't apply, but Carmack may not apply as well, because the shipment initially proceeded from a foreign country. But federal common law is simply Carmack, because Carmack is the codification of federal common law. And in this case, again, if we look, it's the consignor, the shipper, looks to the carrier, the initial carrier, and indicates if there is a damage to the goods or non-delivery, and says you are liable, and it's up to the carrier either to present the defense under federal common law, Carmack, or CAGSA, and perhaps go ahead and sue whoever carrier was in that line that it deems was responsible for the actual loss.
But your theory implies that the consignee can pretty much do anything. If the consignee, instead of saying divert this shipment to the customs inspection station, had said divert this shipment to, let's say, a private lot that we operate because we want to inspect the cargo while it's still in the Chicago area and easy to move out before it gets all the way to Indiana. So they give, in other words, contrary instructions to what were in the original bill. Your theory is that Hanjin's still responsible for that too, and I think the thing that is important about this case is the cargo gets diverted because the consignee has asked for a diversion, not because somebody else did, not because the carrier wanted to divert it.
Your Honor, we respectfully disagree. In this case, we didn't ask for the customs examination. The United States Customs Office did. In that case that you indicated,
your instructions, though, I don't see how you can deny that.
But, Your Honor, in this case, when the parties entered into the contract, they know that goods shipped from a foreign country may get examined by customs. They don't know, however, if we, the consignee or the shipper, says, hey, don't send it to North Vernon, Indiana. Instead, just drop it off in Iowa instead. In that case, the Act of Shipper Defense would apply, because now we're telling them we don't want the place of delivery anymore to be North Vernon, Indiana, but we want it Iowa. And
but
that's active shipper. But in this case...
No. You're saying that the reason that you have for diverting it is dispositive legally. If your reason is a business reason, you're saying then active shipper applies. If your reason is because you want to comply with U.S. customs law, then the active shipper defense doesn't apply. What legal rule would support such a line?
First, the contract in this case, which does indicate if you want the place of delivery to be elsewhere, you have to sign it. And we understand from this case that they have to deliver to the place of delivery. In this case, we, the shipper itself or the consignee, didn't say send it to a private location. We really don't want it any longer in North Vernon, Indiana. It's customs that made the decision to examine the goods. Again, Your Honor, it's already contemplated by the parties before they execute this contract that there might be a customs examination, because it's done. It's in particular from foreign goods arriving from foreign countries. If you look at the contract, it's Hanjin's contract. If they felt that they didn't want to have that risk of loss, they should have indicated that we don't want the payment. We don't want to take it to North Vernon.
So this case teaches us, if you're correct, you just have to contract around this event. Is that the law that ought to come out of this case?
I think it's probably one of them, as well as the fact that I do not believe that their defense, if it is active shipper defense under either CAGSA, CARMAC, or federal common law, was actually proven in this case under the fact.
But, you know, if I understand you have a judgment against Hanjin, so you want to defend that, but that aside, what difference does it make to you, to your insured, if you get compensated by Hanjin or the distribution company that has a lot, as long as you get paid? Why do you care?
That is absolutely correct, Judge. We don't care. It's for us, we're not here because of just to argue the theory of law. If we have gotten, if we had been paid during the settlement conference, we would not be here today. And that's true.
Commend you for your
and
standards.
If I may, Your Honor, again, we ask that the district court's ruling, as in against Hanjin, be upheld. I would like to address our cross-appeal at this time. We believe that the district court, however, was incorrect in ruling and dismissing our bailment and negligence claims against Channel Distribution and O'Hare Services. In that ruling, and that's in the trial transcript, the court essentially indicated two reasons why it was ruling in favor of Channel Distribution and O'Hare. And in one of them, the court indicated that the evidence didn't show what happened to the goods, as Your Honor indicated in a question earlier. We felt that that was unfair to us because we never had control of the goods. The goods are in the other defendant's lot. The court seems to indicate that we failed to show what the actual cause of the loss was, what happened, did they just disappear or did someone steal them? But under bailment law, that was not our burden. Our burden was simply to state we gave them the goods, they had it, they didn't give it back to us. And then it's up to them to at least, at the very minimum, explain what occurred. Once they explained that, then we would get the burden again to show that they did something negligent in failing to safeguard those goods.
Is it your position that the district court basically confused, as a matter of law, the principles of bailment law and the principles of negligence law? I mean, he was moving over to proximate causation, for example, without looking at those elements of bailment that you just stated.
Yes, Your Honor. Your Honor, I don't want to say that the district court was confused. Certainly, we were confused by the ruling, and we feel that it was that the district court misapplied bailment law because there is talk of proximate causation, but in ruling with respect to proximate causation, the district court again talked about the foreseeable risk. And in that ruling, which is in the transcript, the district court indicated that we, the plaintiff, didn't prove that there was a thief out there lurking to steal the goods. Again, we think actually there was that proof. In other words, there was a duty, and I think that example indicated by the district court moves more towards duty rather than proximate cause. But the facts in the case indicated that the container was in the defendant's lot. They had a fence that they never kept closed, even during non-work hours. They had no lock on the fence. They had no security system with respect to their yard. In contrast, where it came to their offices and warehouse, they obviously had doors, they had locks, and they had an elaborate security system. Further, there was no pin lock placed on the chassis. There was, early on, indication from Alan Muir, I believe, that it was their custom and practice to put pin locks. And a pin lock, I believe he described it, as a mechanism that you put on the chassis to prevent someone from just backing a trailer or a tractor up, hooking it up to the chassis, and moving it along. He indicated the only way you can move a chassis with a pin lock on it is to use a blowtorch or to cut it in some way. They indicated there was no evidence in their lot that there was a broken pin lock. When they attempted to bring up evidence that there was an actual pin lock put on there, we objected as to hearsay, and the district court upheld our objection, and in his ruling indicated that there was no evidence that an actual pin lock was placed on the chassis.
Do we need to decide whether it's Channel or O'Hare as the bailee? This is the same question I asked Mr. Snyder, but I'm trying to see whether it matters or what your theory, at least, of who the bailee is, if you have one.
Your Honor, that's another point in this case where I am also, again, confused. It's our understanding that O'Hare is the custom examination station operator. They're the ones with the license. They're the ones who are ultimately responsible. I think federal regulations did not allow them to confer or assign that license or those rights to somebody else. But the evidence did indicate that they did do that. They gave it to Channel Distribution. So from the evidence that we saw, Channel Distribution may have had actual control of the lot, but O'Hare Services was the designated custom examination station operator. And we think the evidence is clear again in the case that they didn't safeguard the property. As indicated again, and we cited numerous cases where courts have found that a bay lead did not safeguard the property, and in this case, the evidence shows that they did less than in the other cases where the court found that the bay lead breached its duty to safeguard the property. Therefore, Your Honor, we do ask that you reverse the district court's ruling with respect to granting judgment or dismissing our claims as and against Channel Distribution and O'Hare Services.
Thank you,
Your Honor.
Mr. Howey?
I'm sorry that you only have 5 minutes, as is your the next counsel, but
that's quite all right, Your Honor.
Be starting to point in your direction. So.
I hope that that will prove to be more than enough time. May it please the court. I'm Scott Howey. I represent the defendant, Cross Appellee O'Hare Services. Mr. Ostojic is correct that this is largely a theoretical exercise. If you decide in favor of affirming in terms of the decision against Hanjin, it makes little difference, as Mr. Ostojic has mentioned, to him who he collects from.
Why wouldn't Hanjin have subrogation rights against you?
Because Hanjin didn't file any claim against us, as opposed to Channel, which
it
did.
Expired to file any claim against us?
I believe that it has. That I'm not certain of. The question as to O'Hare Services, though, with respect to this appeal, theoretical or not, is whether a non-corporeal legal entity can have physical control of a piece of property such as to be its bailey.
Well, you know, you could phrase it that way, but the thing that's disturbing to me is the net message I got out of your brief and Channel's brief is that if you're clever enough with your delegations, goods can be bailed to you and nobody can be the bailee. And that just doesn't seem right to me. Somebody had control over these goods, and of course corporations are always non-corporeal theoretical entities. They're pieces of paper in the Secretary of State's office. So we'll put that to one side. O'Hare had certain obligations, certain responsibilities as the operator of his facility, and if I understood him correctly, I think Mr. Ostojic just argued that as such, O'Hare on that theory could certainly be considered as the bailee of these goods, and it was really O'Hare's problem to come up with the correct arrangements with anybody else it was contracting with, including Channel, to make sure this was done properly. What's wrong with that?
The problem is that O'Hare was not in a position to have physical custody or control of the goods in question. And while it is certainly true that any corporation is non-corporeal and doesn't itself hold custody, corporations act through their employees and their agents. In this case, there was no employee of O'Hare Services that ever had actual physical control of these.
That's
these
just
goods.
Because O'Hare had a contract with Channel. If O'Hare is the responsible party, I guarantee you O'Hare will find a way of making sure that others it deals with, whether they're employees or agents, safeguard the property.
Respectfully, Your Honor, I would draw a distinction between the question of responsibility, which we can't contest, and physical custody of the goods, which is what is necessary for a bailment. There is no principle of bailment law that speaks to a party's so-called responsibility in a legal sense for goods. It requires physical control, and in fact it requires exclusive physical control. And to that extent, it's significant that even Indemnity's counsel this morning didn't speak to the distinction between the two alleged bailees until Your Honor raised the issue. The fact is that the evidence in the record doesn't show that O'Hare Services had any physical control. In fact, it's even unclear as to which of the two parties, as between Channel and O'Hare, had exclusive physical control such as to be the bailee.
When goods are taken, I take it this is basically O'Hare's business, and when goods are taken to this facility. Is there any kind of paper trail? Does the trucking company or whoever it is who takes the goods, not even necessarily just this case, but just in sort of the general way this business operates, does somebody sign a little receipt that says, we received container number XYZ235 on a certain date?
I can't speak to the general practice. I can speak to the facts of this case, and the record doesn't contain anything showing that O'Hare Services ever accepted or held physical custody of the goods in question.
So is it Channel who signs the receipt, or are people just sort of randomly throw things into this yard and nobody knows who gave it or who's allowed to pick it up?
According to the record, Channel is the only party who has the people, the places, the things to have custody of them.
I know they're the unpackers, but it seems astounding to me that $250,000 in excess of that, of goods, without anybody signing for them and anybody taking responsibility for them, can be so casually moved around.
That may be a shortcoming in the business, but it's a shortcoming that inures to the detriment, in this case, of Channel. And it's important, I think, to also acknowledge we are not accusing Channel of having done anything negligent.
Does O'Hare do anything? I mean, do you collect money? What do you do?
O'Hare does collect money pursuant to the written agreement with Channel. It is the holder of the license from the Customs Service.
When you apply for a license, what representations do you have to make? Do you have to announce you have a facility, or you're going to get a facility? I'm unfamiliar with that. I mean, is it just you have the ticket, so to speak, and you can let anybody else use it?
I would liken it, I think, my understanding, perhaps flawed, is that it is like a taxi cab medallion. It is a license to be able to do something on the understanding that there are going to be people, places, things provided to provide those. There is nothing in the federal regulations, nothing in the law that prohibits the holder of the license from delegating those responsibilities, much in the way that the holder of a taxi medallion might delegate to a driver to actually do the things with the medallion to drive the cab. I'd be happy to address any other questions the court might have, but I see my time has expired. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Howley. Mr. Lechstein?
May it please the court, my name is Bruce Lichtstein, and I represent Channel Distribution in this matter. Although the court seems to be straying away from that in some of its questions, this is fundamentally a dispute between Indemnity and Hanjin, in which O'Hare and Channel are the tail of the dog. I think that fact was driven home rather forcefully from the fact that in Hanjin's opening brief, it devoted all of three paragraphs to why the bailment theory against O'Hare and Channel should apply, and why Channel and O'Hare would be liable in this case.
But you know, Hanjin doesn't really care about that as long as they're not liable.
That is correct.
I'm not surprised they didn't waste too much time in their brief.
That is correct.
Why isn't Channel, in fact, right in the middle of this case, if, as a practical matter, Channel was the company last seen with this container with valuable content?
Channel Distribution could be in the middle of this matter, but there are two very basic points that have been misconstrued thus far as I've heard them. Number one, the question as to O'Hare versus Channel, I think, has been misconstrued. And number two, a question that Mr. Howey, I don't think, got to, is even if there was a Bailey-Bailor relationship, that does not mean that automatically that the Bailey is liable for the disappearance of the goods, because it's certainly the case under the case law that if the Bailey shows and rebuts the presumption of the prima facie case, that there is no negligence, which is what the district court found in this case. But that's the second issue. The first issue that I think the court is trying to get at is who had control of the goods. That issue...
Did Channel give somebody a receipt when the goods showed up?
I don't know if they gave them a receipt, but what happened was the United States Customs asked for an examination, and O'Hare Services is the licensed custom examination station, not Channel. But more importantly, when the goods came to Customs and they were examined, it was done at the direction of the U.S. Customs officials, and it was done with Channel employees. But after that customs examination was over, Channel released the container to O'Hare, and the testimony is undisputed that O'Hare used its material and its mechanics and its machines to transport the container from the site, which is a room for the customs examination, to the area of the yard that it leased from Channel. That was not Channel's control, and it doesn't matter.
I thought O'Hare said it didn't have any of that equipment.
The record is, the record is quite to the opposite, Your Honor. The record is clear that Alan Muir testified that Channel did not even have the equipment to transfer the container.
What does Channel have, a building?
Channel has a building, and it has a yard. There was a sublease between O'Hare and Channel, where O'Hare sublet a portion of the yard for purposes of its facility. It doesn't matter what...
What is Channel's hands-on? I appreciate the property context. What's the literal hands-on that Channel does for O'Hare?
They do warehousing for O'Hare.
Yeah. Is that just the providing of the building, or they actually have people who touch the goods?
I don't know, and the record is completely silent on that point. But as to the dispute in this case, the record is demonstrably clear that O'Hare took the goods, took the container, moved it to a portion of the yard that it sublet from Channel, and it doesn't matter what happened during, it doesn't matter who had possession and control during the customs examination, because that's not when the goods disappeared. The goods disappeared after that, after O'Hare resumed possession and control and custody of the container, and that's when they disappeared.
Maybe my colleagues have got the facts set up. Just walk me through the delivery and of the goods to the facility, if you could, from the record.
To the facility, the container is delivered.
Okay.
Then the customs official then selects a portion of the container that it would like to examine.
And who takes that, who touches that?
The people who touch it are Channel employees at the direction of U.S. Customs.
Right.
And at that point, who touches them.
Okay.
Channel employees.
And at some point, the inspection is concluded.
Correct.
And Channel employees replace the goods in the container.
Reseal and replace.
Right. And then what happens?
Then they turn it over to O'Hare. And O'Hare, by the testimony of Alan Muir, transports that container from within the building to a place on the lot that they sublet from Channel. And
why would O'Hare, excuse me, I'll give you an extra, before I lose this train, why would O'Hare employ the facilities of a Channel? If you're more than the landlord, you have extra workers? I mean, you've got O'Hare, Channel workers and O'Hare workers, is that both touching these goods?
Not during the customs examination, but afterwards, the testimony is that O'Hare used its employees and its machinery to transport to the portion of the yard. That's what the testimony is.
Well,
whether it makes sense is another question.
I'm sure it has some economic sense. It's just, I just don't have it quite framed up yet. I'll just have to look at the record. Judge Evans?
This seems like the light is going on and all the mice are running away from the cheese. So
that's a Wisconsin expression.
I think we'd like to hear Mr. Howell again. Just respond to that if you agree.
The fact setting.
Yeah, that factual scenario. That
were you concluding with your remarks?
Well, I think my time is concluded.
Well, I didn't want to cut you off.
Well, the only point that I would like to make, which I addressed in my opening remarks, is that no matter whether O'Hare or Channel had custody and control of the goods, the fact is that there was a complete absence of any evidence after after both of our clients put on evidence of the reasonableness of the conduct during the time that the container was in the lot. And because of that, the district court correctly found that we had fulfilled our obligation under the law when the burden switched back to us. We rebutted that presumption, and the plaintiff was completely silent after that.
Thank you. Sir Howie, would you step up a second? Judge Evans wanted to ask you a question.
I mean, I just understood your remarks earlier that all you have is a piece of, you have a license, and
that's correct.
The other comment was that your people are moving things around, and
there's a distinction to be drawn between O'Hare Services and its parent corporation, GOTO.
GOTO. Now we're getting somewhere.
GOTO is not a party at all to this litigation, and there is evidently some confusion in the record as to, in the briefing on Channel's part, as to whether it was O'Hare or GOTO whose employees were involved here. The evidence in the record, however, is clear that if anyone other than Channel had any custody or control of these goods, it was GOTO and not O'Hare Services. We maintain and continue to maintain that there is no evidence, certainly that O'Hare had exclusive custody or control, no evidence even that GOTO had exclusive custody or control, and for that matter, no evidence that Channel had exclusive custody
or control. GOTO is an entity, is a holding company, is the parent of O'Hare?
GOTO is the parent. GOTO, G-O-T-O-H. Is the parent corporation of O'Hare Services.
So in your parlance, who owns the medallion?
O'Hare Services owns the medallion. And that is, I mean, that's, it's more than parlance. It's they are the licensed centralized examination station.
I appreciate that.
As licensed by the Customs Service. And we, of course, second, as long as I'm back here for the moment, I second everything Mr. Lichtenstein said with respect to there being no proof of or no evidence in response to our having rebutted the presumption of negligence. Thank you.
Mr. Snyder?
Thank you.
You have 4 minutes.
Well, this is fresh in your mind.
This daisy chain of custodianship. I mean, how's Hanjin to deal with that? It not only didn't select O'Hare or Channel or GOTO, and how is it to foresee that its container that it has carried so safely from Shenzhen, China, to Chicago is going to end up in the hands of this mixmaster?
Well, the weak point for your case, as I see it, is if there's credit to be given to some sort of evidence that everything was done and you were told that this was available and you didn't timely supply a number or didn't come there and pick this thing up. That seems to be the soft spot of your
I'm going to get right to that right now. I'm going to answer that question right now, and I'm going to answer it with the testimony of the two men who Mr. Goto describes as a partnership in this record.
Oh, there's a Mr. Goto.
Yes, Yoshio Goto.
Okay.
He testified on behalf of O'Hare Services, and Mr. Alan Muir testified on behalf of Channel Distribution. This is the record. My learned friend seemed to have forgotten it. Cross-examination of Mr. Goto by Mr. Snyder. Mr. Goto, was this container sent to O'Hare Service by Fritz Company? This is, yes, Fritz Company's broker, as far as I know. And is it the function of a customs house broker to send containers to O'Hare Services for intense examination? Yes, correct. And who does O'Hare Services, Inc. take its direction from with respect to the handling of containers and the release of containers? Examination-wise, U.S. Customs tells us which shipments we're supposed to handle there. And when the customs is satisfied, what is the next step toward moving the container along to destination? Answer, in that case, we receive customs clearance form. That means consignment was cleared through customs. Then once we receive that paperwork, we can process then by notifying, in this case, Agent Fritz. Shipment was cleared and come and pick it up. So how then do you release the cargo to whoever Fritz sends to pick it up. What do they need to present to you to get the container out of O'Hare Services, Inc.? Answer, first of all, payment has to be made to O'Hare Services. Number two, they have to bring a pickup order that's a trucker, whoever they have assigned, that they are right party to pick up. Question, and who issues the pickup order? Answer, Agent Fritz. And so you are expecting a pickup order issued by Fritz to release this container. That's correct. Do they want to ever appear with a pickup order issued by Fritz? I have no idea. You don't know anything that Hanjin did that contributed to cause this theft, do you, sir? I have no idea. And you don't know of anything that Hanjin failed to do that contributed to cause this theft, do you, sir? Answer, no. Then Mr. Muir's testimony, as I represented to the court, is congruent. Alan Muir.
So while you're looking for that, I take it then that you are arguing that to the extent the district court may have relied on the account of Ms. Walker, that it was simply clearly erroneous?
Oh, it definitely.
I mean, it just as a technical matter. I mean, the district court committed clear error in looking at that.
If it did rely on it.
If it did.
I mean, it made no specific finding of fact, and that's unfortunate because if it had said, I believe Ms. Walker, and I think that Hanjin's witness and Mr. Goto and Mr. Muir were untruthful, I don't believe them, we'd have a whole different ballgame than we have here.
Okay.
Thank God we don't have a different ballgame.
But the court,
you know,
if you follow, this got to be reversed. If you follow the district court's holding that Hanjin had to deliver these goods to Mount Vernon, Indiana, no carrier can ever be safe in undertaking to transport goods under a through bill of lading and get instructions from its consignee to send them someplace else. Can you imagine Lowe saying to Hanjin, look, we've changed our mind. We want these goods to go to Pennsylvania. And Hanjin says, oh, really? Well, that's too bad. I'm going to follow the law of the United States District Court for the Northern District of Illinois, and I'm taking these down to North Vernon, Indiana, and I'm going to deliver them there according to the bill of lading, and if you want to pick them up and take them to Pennsylvania, that's your business.
This couldn't be addressed by a contract modification?
Well, our position is it was addressed by contract modification.
I understand that, but your fear of what would follow from an adverse or following the district court's approach couldn't be addressed by contract?
Well, apparently not to the satisfaction of this district court, because this district court says that the place of delivery trumps all other considerations. And we simply don't agree that that's
Let me all. Just ask one last question. I know we're running over time. The active shipper was, Judge Norville referred to it as a mere technicality.
Right.
Do you have a sense of how that came about? Was there some exchange or argument?
No, it was a complete surprise to me. The first case I argued before this court in 1972, Ontmid Inc. versus Fiala Orange Line, was an act of the shipper defense case, and this court didn't refer to it as a technical defense and had no problem affirming the district court's exoneration of the carrier.
Thanks to all counsel. The case is